Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven.
Promised you all that there would be monsters aplenty for us to dive into in our journey back into the past. Once again, I intend to deliver. Today, we're going to talk about one of the most vicious and brutal human beings to ever walk the face of our planet. And that man is known as Attila the Hun, but he is a man who earned a mighty nickname for his great cruelty. A man who earned the nickname Flagellum Dig, which means the Scourge of God. Now, for those of you unfamiliar with Attila the Hun, I can promise you that today you're not only going to learn about him, you're going to learn about his people, the Huns, people who were known for their great prowess in battle. But more than that, they were known for being a tough, hardy, nomadic people. Now, the origin of the Huns is still a matter of heavy debate. Empire in what we would now consider to be the eastern part of Europe, from the Caucasus and parts of Central Asia. Now, the Huns themselves are first reported to have been living east of the Volga River in an area that was part of Scythia at the time. Now, the Huns' arrival is associated with the migration westward of a Scythian people, the Alans. By 370 AD, the Huns had arrived on the Volga, and by 430, they had established a vast, if short-lived, dominion in Europe. Now, the Huns themselves have been linked to a number of nomadic peoples. The first of these peoples is the Xiongyu people, who were northern neighbors of China in the 3rd century. However, there's no real scholarly consensus on the direct connection between them and the Huns. Mention other historians, particularly a 5th century Roman diplomat and Greek historian by the name of Priscus, mentions that the Huns had a language of their own, though little of it has survived, and its relationships have mainly been considered to be Turkic or Mongolic languages. Numerous other ethnic groups were included under Attila the Hun's rule, including very many speakers of Gothic, which some scholars describe as a lingua franca of the empire. Their main military technique was mounted archery, making them a tremendously mobile military force. Now, there is a great event in early human history called the Great Migration, and this is a time in which numerous tribes of people from various parts of Asia, Central Europe, and Eastern Europe begin to move westward, begin to move towards the western part of the Roman Empire. And there are a great number of reasons. In some cases, it's famine. In some cases, people are looking for food because of shortages. In some cases, there's overcrowding. But one great factor heavily debated, and that is the incursion of the Huns, who had begun carving a bloody path through Eastern Europe at this time, forcing a great number of tribes, in particular the Visigoths, to move into the western part of the Roman Empire. Now, it's still a matter of debate as to the true source of the Huns, although there's not really a consensus as to where they really came from. Many people suggest that they probably were one of the nomadic tribes that came down from the Asian steppes. much like the Mongolians and some of the other Turkish tribes from that area of the world, it's suspected that their origins can be traced to an area of the world we now know to be Kazakhstan. Nonetheless, wherever they may have came from, one thing is absolutely certain. When they arrived in Eastern Europe, they began a campaign the likes of which the Romans, the Visigoths, and the tribes of this area had never seen before. They swept across this part of the world like a plague, leaving death, destruction, and burning cities in their wake. For miles, men became feasts for crows. Now, we enter in Attila the Hun. Now, Attila himself reigned what we now know to be called the Hunnic Empire, which he established. He was the ruler and leader of the Huns from the year 434 to the year 453 CE. Now, it's not a very long rule, but in the time of his rule, his name would strike fear into the masses from the western part of the Roman Empire all the way into Central Europe. People would speak of his name in hushed tones. Now, his name itself translates to little father. Now, according to some historians, this may not have been his birth name, but a term of affection and respect conferred on his accession to rule. This name, however, was synonymous with terror amongst his enemies and the general populace of the territories that his army swept through. Now, Attila's incursions into the regions of Germania drove the populations across the borders of the Western Empire and contributed to its decline in the late 5th century. The influx of Visigoths, as I previously mentioned, and their later revolt against Rome is considered to be a significant contributor to the dissolution of part of the Roman Empire as we know it during this time. This contributed to the Visigoths being forced to enter into this part of the empire, where they would be forced to fight the Romans for territory. And this culminated in a battle known as the Battle of Adrianople in 378 CE, and it's an event that the Roman military never truly fully recovered from. Further, that victory encouraged the Huns to join the Goths, their former adversaries, in plundering the Roman territories. Now, it's important to note that there are a number of Gothic tribes in this part of the world at this time, and one of them is the Ostrogoths. The Ostrogoths end up becoming part of the mighty horde that Attila commands later on. The reason they end up becoming part of it is because they're given little choice. As Attila begins carving out his empire from the Caucasus all the way into the Western Roman Empire, it becomes clear that there is only one choice. That choice is join or die. Now, the apparent weakness of Rome encouraged Attila once he became leader of the Huns. Now, how did Attila become leader of the Huns? Well, Attila has a very interesting history himself. Now, he was born in what is now considered to be Hungary. At least most historians agree on this, around the year 406. Attila and his brother Bleda were named the co-rulers of the Huns in 434. Now, in the year 445, Attila decided that his brother, he awakened one day and realized that being in control of half of his people was all well and good, but being in control of all of them was even better. And so Attila murdered his brother, violently, I might add, snuck into his room and took him out, solidifying himself as the 5th century king of his new empire and the sole ruler of the Huns. Attila would unite the tribes of the Hun kingdom and was said to be a just ruler to his own people, but was an aggressive and ruthless leader. He expanded the rule of the Huns to include many Germanic tribes and attacked the Eastern Roman Empire in wars of extraction, devastating lands from the Black Sea to the Mediterranean and inspiring fear throughout the late Roman Empire. Attila himself was notorious for his fierce gaze, and according to one historian, he frequently rolled his eyes as if to enjoy the terror that he inspired. Interestingly enough, Attila often liked to play on the fears of the people he intended to rule. Superstition and traditions, stories of great warriors reached his ears as he expanded into the Mediterranean. He became familiar with the customs and the culture of the people that he was encountering. And rumors entered his ears of a mighty weapon possessed by a great god in the sky known as Mars. Mars, the god of war in Roman mythology, and also in the Roman pantheon, I should say, and in the Greek pantheon known as Ares. Attila the Hun, knowing the impact that would have on his enemies' psychological well-being, claimed that he possessed the sword of Mars himself, and that any man who dares stand against him would be cut down like grass as he and his hordes entered into the Roman Empire. In the year 434, the Roman Emperor Theodosius II paid a tribute in essence. This tribute was protection money to Attila. Attila was not impressed with this bribe. Instead, after accepting the tribute and hearing words about treaties and peace, he decided to break this deal. He destroyed towns along the Danube River before he moved into the empire's interior, where he began laying waste to cities left and right. He started at Naissus, which is now Nice, and then proceeded to Sirdica or Sofia. He then moved towards Constantinople, which is now present-day Istanbul, for those of you not in the know on that, and defeated the main Eastern Roman forces in a number of battles. Upon reaching the sea, both north and south of Constantinople, however, Attila realized the impossibility of an attack on the capital's great walls by his army, which consisted largely of horsemen. Now, these horsemen, for those of you unaware, possessed composite bows. These bows were able to fire arrows at an extremely terrifying and alarmingly quick rate. The mobility of Attila's armies gave him a distinct advantage over the infantry that the Romans deployed. Now it's important to note that the Romans themselves did cavalry, but they were nothing like Attila's lightly armored cavalry. The lightly armored cavalry of Attila was something to be feared. They moved in quick, they encircled their enemies, and they would fire rapid-fire bows directly into their enemies. Now, these bows on their own were pretty solid for the time period in which they were being used. But it wasn't the bows themselves that had the stopping power. It's the fact that his men were able to fire them at such a fast rate and to be able to do so from horseback. Their mobility and their superior weaponry gave them advantages over the Romans that the heavy infantry and the heavily armored cavalry of the Romans could not overcome in the open field. However, Attila knew that he couldn't assault one of these large cities with his army because he did have some infantry, but they were lightly armored, and often the majority of his forces would consist of horsemen, was to raid cities and pretty much sweep through, kill everybody that they could, burn it, and move on. But the heavy heavily fortified walls of Constantinople made this tactic not feasible in this scenario. And so Attila decided to move on. Now, important, we should also note that Theodosius II supposedly had specifically built the great walls of his city to defend against Attila and roving bands like his. So instead of attacking Constantinople and laying siege to it, Attila decided to refocus his efforts on destroying what was left of the Eastern Rome. And so he and his horde broke off into a dead sprint headlong towards death, and not their own deaths. They would backtrack, hunt down, and systematically wipe out the Eastern Roman Empire's military in the field before they could get to fortified locations. Now, in the year 441, Attila decided to strike again. He invaded the area of the world we now know to be the Balkans, which is most of Eastern Europe. Now, when Theodosius begged for terms, Attila's tribute was tripled. But in 447, Pyrrhus again and negotiated yet another new treaty. When we talk about these tributes, it doesn't sound like he's getting a very good deal, right? Well, let's take a look at what the first tribute was like. Now, before Attila took over his horde, I mentioned that he and his elder brother, Bleda, inherited this horde of men and inherited their empire, which stretched from the Alps to the Baltic Sea in the west, somewhere near the Caspian Sea in the east, which is quite vast. Now, their first known action on becoming joint rulers was the negotiation of a peace treaty with the Eastern Roman Empire, which was concluded at the city of Margus, or Pozarabic. Now, by the terms of the treaty, the Romans undertook to double the subsidies that they had been paying the Huns prior to Attila and his brother taking over. And in the future, to pay 700 pounds of gold every year. 700 pounds of gold is the starting price to keep Attila and his brother away from the Eastern Roman Empire. That is an enormous amount of gold. That's an enormous amount of money now. 700 pounds of gold. Now, from the year 435 to the year 439, the activities of Attila are relatively unknown, as he seems to have been engaged in subduing other barbaric tribes to the north or east of his dominions and subsequently integrating them into his army. Among these are the Ostrogoths, some Visigoths, and other tribes that he was subduing. During this time period, however, the Eastern Romans don't appear to have paid the sums stipulated in the Treaty of Margus. And so it's then in 441, as we were trekking together, that Attila returns. And when the Romans are occupied in the west and on the east, eastern frontier, dealing with the Visigoths and a number of other pesky tribes, the Vandals, the Magyars, a few others, Attila decides to saddle up the majority of his forces and launch a devastatingly heavy assault on the Danubian frontier of the Eastern Empire. He captures and raises a number of important cities, among them some of the ones we talked about, but also Belgrade, at the time is known as Segedunum. And the Eastern Romans do not manage to arrange a truce for this until a year later in 442, and they recall it's at this point that they had managed to recall their forces from the west. But again, in 443, Attila resumes his attack. He begins by taking and destroying towns on the Danube and penetrating deep into the interior of the empire, where he destroys Nice and Sirtica, both of which he levels to the ground, leaving nothing behind but corpses, ash, and ruins. He then turns toward Constantinople, taking Philippopolis, and defeating the main Eastern Roman forces in a succession of battles in which the Romans managed to not take a single battle. The greatest army the world had ever seen to this point succeeds in not securing a single victory. They are devastated in the field by the Huns. The Huns unleashed a fury upon them that all the military training, the best training that you could get at the time, the best education could not prepare these men for the wrath of the Huns. They swept across the Eastern Roman Empire like a disease, and no one was safe, especially not the soldiers. Now, before we continue on with this, talk about the next tribute paid to Attila. And ultimately, we dig a little deeper into Attila's raids into this part of the world, Central Europe specifically. We're going to take a commercial break. At this point, I'd like to remind everybody that here at Totally Driven Entertainment, we have a proud new sponsor. He's crazy. He's funny. Totally Driven. Check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com. When we come back, guys, we're going to talk a little bit more about Attila the Hun's incursions into Central Europe and what people were doing to try and push back the unending tide of his horde. We'll also talk a little bit more about what it was like to grow up as a Hun. And before we go to commercial break, I'd like to remind everybody that we do have a guest call-in number that you can call anytime. It's 718-508-9883. I'll see you all after the break. Do enjoy the commercial.
I am black man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the black mother. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is a perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your cool friend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the commercial break. Now, before the break, I promised you we'd talk a little bit more about the incursions of Attila and his Huns, but I also told you we'd talk a little bit more about the Huns themselves. Now, before we get more into Attila and what he and his Huns were doing to the Empire, they had already received these massive bribes to stay away, but they kept coming back because they smelled blood in the water. They smelled weakness. But what was it that made the Huns so able to smell this weakness? What was it about them that compelled them, besides Attila and his ambition, what was it that compelled them to do this? People of the time told stories of the Huns and spoke of them in fear. But there were reasons for this. Historians tell us that the Huns themselves had prejudices. Specifically, that made them absolutely horrifying to behold. Now, these two practices were brought about to raise their warriors, and that would be the priests, the shamans, and the mothers. Numerous quotes refer to the fearful appearance of the Huns. They made their foes flee in horror because their swarthy aspect was fearful, and they had, if I may call it so, a sort of shapeless lump rather than a head, with pinholes rather than eyes. Their hardihood is evident in their wild appearance, and they are beings who are cruel to their children from the day that they are born. For they cut of males with a sword, so that before they receive the nourishment of their mother's breast, they must learn to endure the wounds of war. Hence they grow old, beardless, and their young men are without comeliness, because the face furrowed by the sword spoils by its scars the natural beauty of a beard. They are short in stature, quick in bodily movement, alert horsemen, broad-shouldered, ready in the use of bow and arrow, and have firm-set necks which are ever erect in pride. Though they live in the form of men, they have the cruelty of wild beasts in their blood. Now, this is a direct quote from Jordanes, a Goth writing in Italy in 551, a century after the collapse of the Hunnic Empire, and he describes the Huns as a savage race which dwelt at first in the swamps, a stunted, foul, and rather pathetic tribe, scarcely human, and having no language of their own, but that bore slight resemblance to human speech. Now, this can be attributed to the fact that there is some hard feelings between people of Italy and the Huns well after the dissolution of both their empires. However, Jordanes also recounted how Priscus had described Attila the Hun, and Priscus, a man who I mentioned earlier, a historian of that time, the emperor of the Huns from the years 434 to 453, is a man of short stature with a broad chest, a large head. His eyes were small, his beard thin and sprinkled with gray, and he had a flat nose, again showing evidence of his quote-unquote origin. Now, informing their view of the of Attila and his people, the Romans tapped into attitudes inherited from the Greeks. These were the vilest creatures imaginable. They came from the north, and everyone knew the colder the climate was, the more more barbaric the people were. And they knew nothing of metal, had no religion, lived like savages, without fire, eating their food raw, living off roots and meat tenderized by placing it under their horse saddles. They had no buildings, of course, not so much as a reed hut. Indeed, they feared the very idea of venturing under a roof. The description of the Huns given by the Romans is prompting historians to believe that they were of East Asian origin. Mentioning again, there's many who believe that they are from the Asian steppes. Now, there's no reason to question the basic accuracy of the Western depictions. According to one writer, Denise Senor, in the absence of massive supportive evidence by physical anthropology cannot weaken the point they so telling to make. It is the unusual that most attract attention. However, one traveler, Mencken Haufen, wrote in the 20th century, Amenius's description begins with a strange misunderstanding. This was repeated by Claudius and Sidonius and reinterpreted by another. Amenius's explanation of the thin beards is wrong. Like so many other people, the Huns inflicted wounds on their live flesh as a sign of grief when their kinsmen were dying. Now, one thing we do know that was practiced by the Huns for sure, they practiced a form of artificial cranial deformation, and sometimes tribes under their influence also practice this. Artificial cranial deformation of the circular type can be used to trace the route the Huns took from North China to the Central Asian steppes and subsequently to the Southern Russian steppes. The people who practice annular type of artificial cranial deformation in Central Asia were the Kushans and the Yuezhi. Now, some artificially deformed crania from the 5th and 6th century AD have been found in northeastern Hungary and elsewhere in Western Europe. None of them have any Mongol-like features, and all the skulls appear Europoid. These skulls may have belonged to Germanic or other subject groups whose parents wished to elevate their status by following the custom introduced to them by the Huns. And we do know, now, what is this artificial cranial deformation that they're talking about? Well, the Romans and the Greeks described the Huns as appearing to be not human. They described them as being animalistic, very strange in appearance, with misshapen heads, scarred faces. Now, whether or not they scarred the cheeks of their boys when they were born is still a matter of debate. But it is not unlikely, as there are in several cultures, practices involving the scarring of one's flesh to, again, show one's grief for fallen kinsmen, but also as rites of passage for young men. Important to note that it is pretty much, it's really not much of a debate as to whether or not the Huns ate meat tenderized that they had under their saddle. As to whether or not they actually ate it raw is another, that's another debate entirely, but it is likely that they did keep their meat under their saddle to the meat that they intended to eat under their saddle to tenderize it. Plus, it would also keep relatively warm up against a horse's body, as you might well know, therefore helping to soften it up. And an army on the go has got to eat something, so it's probably not unlikely that they probably ate dried strips of meat, maybe even horse meat, or whatever else they could get their hands on at this time. A nomadic people tended to live off the land, eating, you know, whatever animals that they could kill, and perhaps even eating roots and other plants. But what is this artificial cranial deformation? Well, the Huns were known for wrapping the heads of their young children when they were born. They believed that this was an aesthetic look that not only separated them and made them distinct in appearance, but also it was the desired look that they believed was comely. And by that, I mean they believed this was attractive. The Huns believed fully that this way of wrapping one's head and shaping the head was an attractive thing. And for those of you familiar with Chinese culture, the Chinese had a practice known as the wrapping of the feet. The idea was that people who had smaller feet were attractive. They were prettier. And so young girls tended to wrap their feet in an attempt to sort of shrink their feet and make them more attractive. These were attractive traits that the Huns believed were attractive, and that is this shaping of the head made them distinct. It separated them from the people around them, and it made them feel pretty good about themselves. Now, that being said, had grown up in. This is the sort of culture that he inspired and promoted. Now, when we left Attila, we had talked about the bribes that he received. So what was this next bribe? Well, after he took Philippopolis and defeated the eastern forces of Rome and reached the sea both north and south of Constantinople, he realized still that his army probably ought not attack Constantinople. It's heavily walled, heavily fortified, and his army was in no condition to lay siege to a city. So Attila turned on the remnants of the empire's forces, which had withdrawn into the peninsula of what is now known as Gallipoli, and he utterly, completely decimated them. He destroyed every single legion in between him and Constantinople, none alive. In the peace treaty that followed, he obliged the Eastern Roman Empire to pay the arrears of tribute. And he calculated this tribute himself. He believed that the Roman Empire should pay him 6,000 pounds of gold. And then and this was up front. After determining that 6,000 pounds of gold should be paid to him up front, he then tripled the annual tribute, henceforth extorting that from here on and in perpetuity, the Roman Empire each year shall pay him 2,100 pounds of gold a year. And should they fail to meet this tribute, Attila would return and leave nothing. Now, Attila's movements after the conclusion of peace in the autumn of 443 are unknown. Following this, he murdered his brother and ruled the Huns with absolute power. And that's in the year 445. So at this point in time, he and his brother were together. Now, he made his second great attack on the Eastern Roman Empire in 447, but little is known of the details of his campaign specifically. It was planned on an even bigger scale than that of the 441 to 443 campaign, and its main weight was directed specifically towards the provinces of Lower Scythia and Moesia, which is in southeastern Europe, farther east than the earlier assault. He would engage the Eastern Empire's forces on the Vid River and defeat them, but he himself suffered serious losses in this battle. The desperation of the Romans made them fight ever more vigorously to stop him. He then devastated the Balkan provinces and drove southward into Greece, where he was only finally stopped short at Thermopylae. 3 years following the invasion were filled with complicated negotiations between Attila and the diplomats of the Eastern Roman Empire, Theodosius II. Now, information about these diplomatic encounters has been preserved in the fragments of the history of Priscus of Panium, who visited Attila's headquarters in Wallachia in a company with a Roman embassy in 449. The treaty by which the war was terminated was harsher than that of the year 443, and the Eastern Romans had to evacuate an enormous belt of territory south of the Danube, and the tribute payable by them was continued, though the rate agreed to is unknown, but said to have been substantial. Since he likely tripled it again, it would be most likely that it was probably tripled. Attila's next great campaign was the invasion of Gaul in 451, and he appears to have at this time been on friendly terms with the Roman general Aetius, the real ruler of the West at this time, and his motives for marching into Gaul had not really been recorded. He announced that his objective in the West was the kingdom of the Visigoths, a Germanic people who conquered parts of the Roman Empire centered on Tolosa, which is now Toulouse. Now, that he had and he claims that he had no quarrel with the Western Emperor, Valentinian III. But in the spring of 450, Honoria, the emperor's sister, sent her ring to Attila, asking him to rescue her from a marriage that had been arranged for her. Attila thereupon claimed Honoria as his wife and demanded half the Western Empire as her dowry. When Attila had already entered Gaul, Aetius reached an agreement with the Visigothic king Theodoric I to combine their forces in resisting the Huns. Now, there are numerous legends that surround the campaign that followed, but one thing is certain. Attila very nearly succeeded in occupying almost all of Aurelianum or Orleans at this time, the city of Orleans. Now, before the Allies arrived, the Huns had already gained a footing inside the city when Aetius and Theodoric forced them to withdraw, and this culminated in a decisive engagement known as the Battle of the Catalaunian Plains, or according to some authorities of Morica, both places are unidentified, however. Now, after fierce fighting, in which Theodoric I was actually killed, Attila withdrew and shortly afterward retired from Gaul. It's important to note that over Attila's violent career, this was the only time that he had ever been defeated. He had never prior been defeated at any battle. This was the first defeat that he and the Huns ever suffered. Following his defeat, in the year 452, the Huns under Attila invaded Italy and sacked several cities. Among them were Aquileia, Padua, Verona, Brescia, Bergamo, and what would now be today Milan. And during these assaults across the western part of the Roman Empire, even General Aetius could do nothing to stop them. The famine and pestilence that began raging in Italy as a consequence of the Huns' activity, though, compelled the Huns to leave without crossing the Apennines. The people of Italy and particular the surrounding areas of Rome, had suffered greatly at the hands of Attila and his armies, but they had suffered even more so from the desolation and destruction they left behind, salting the land as they left, burning crops, burning farmland, sacking cities, burning them to the ground, leaving few survivors. And with so few people alive in these areas, there was little enough people to work the fields that did remain. And his hordes with very little in plunder to take at this point. In the year 453, Attila was intending to attack the Eastern Empire once again, where the new emperor Marcian had refused to pay the subsidies agreed upon by his predecessor, Theodosius II. But during the night following his marriage, Attila would die in his sleep. Many say he died specifically of a bloody nose. Now, it's debated as to whether or not he died as a consequence of foul play or whether or not he was assassinated. But many historians have said that it's most likely that Attila the Hun died of a brain hemorrhage that he was unaware that he had, and this caused him to have this unstoppable bloody nose, and he would die, slip into a coma and die. Now, following his death, those who buried Attila and his treasures were subsequently put to death by the Huns so that his grave might never be discovered. He was succeeded by his sons, who divided his empire among them. Now, according to historians, Attila was, though of an irritable, blustering, and truculent disposition, a very persistent negotiator, and by no means was he pitiless. It was said that in banquets The only thing Attila ever ate was meat, whereupon his chief lieutenants dined off silver platters loaded with dainties. Attila was served off wooden plates only and devoured only meat. No descriptions of his qualities as a general survive, but his successes before the invasion of Gaul show him to have been an outstanding commander. Now, before his death and his invasion of northern Italy in 452, Attila the Hun earned flagellum Dei in Latin, meaning the scourge of God. His invasion in 452, involving the sacking of these cities, Milan and Bergamo and the like, were violent, brutal, and terrifying to behold. Upon arriving in Rome before leaving Italy, it is said that it was only due to the diplomacy of Pope Leo I and the rough shape of his own troops and the lack of plunder in the area that made Attila leave. Now, there are numerous legends surrounding these negotiations, but legend has it that St. Peter and Paul appeared to Attila, threatening to strike him dead if he did not settle with Pope Leo I. Most likely, this is some nonsense made up by Pope Leo I's great propagators. Popes during this time had some great publicists. Nonetheless, Attila would leave behind in his death a very divided family. His appointed successor, his oldest son, Eloc, fought with his other sons, Degazinc and Ernoc, over control of their father's empire, which ultimately ended up being divided among them. Among the many memorable quotes left by Attila, Attila the Hun is remembered most for saying of his powerful reign, "Where I have passed, the grass shall never grow again." Ladies and gentlemen, I do hope you've enjoyed today. Truly, we've seen great horrors committed at the hands of the Huns. But the story is not over. We're going to take one more commercial break, and when we return, we're going to talk a little bit more about what the contemporaries of Attila the Hun and his interactions, the neighboring tribes, such as the Goths, through the eyes of one historian by the name of Jordanes and another by the name of Priscus. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Huns' interactions with those around them, and we're going to talk a little bit more about Attila himself and how people of his time viewed him. So, we're going to take this commercial break. We're going to talk a little bit more about these extraordinary people and about this extraordinary individual. Even though we've talked about his life from beginning sort of to end, there are some gaps we need to fill. And those gaps are not only the achievements of Attila. We talked about those. We've talked about, to a degree, about what people were saying about him. But it's important that we get an idea of his impact on the region. So when we come back, we will talk about that. In the meantime, I do hope you guys will enjoy the commercial break. We do have a proud new sponsor at Totally Driven Entertainment. He's funny, he's wacky, and he's crazy. Check out ChrisFrigleyPresents.com, and I will see you all after the break.
I'm Black Man. Baby Man dies. One stage at a time.
To the Black Mother. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard, pronto.
Will Black Man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. To keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin on the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
Welcome back, everybody. And we've talked about Attila's life, we've talked about his achievements, and we've tapped a little bit into the culture that he created and the culture that people were exposed to. We did talk a little bit about how other people were talking about him, but let's talk a little bit more about how the other peoples around them were interpreting Attila and his people. Now, I quoted the historian Jourdain from the 6th century, who wrote, "The only account of the Goths still extant includes their interactions with the Huns, and he describes Attila at length, that he was a man born into the world to shake the nations." And this is what he's speaking about Attila. Let me be specific. And if anybody has any questions, feel free to call in to our call-in number, 718-508-9883. I'd be happy to answer them. But these are the words of the historian Jourdain. He says that Attila was a man born into the world to shake the nations, the scourge of all lands, who in some way terrified all mankind by the rumors noised abroad concerning him. He was haughty in his walk, rolling his eyes hither and thither so that the power of his proud spirit appeared in the movement of his body. He was indeed a lover of war, yet restrained in action, mighty in counsel, gracious to suppliants, and lenient to those who were once received under his protection. He was short of stature, with a broad chest and a large head. His eyes were small, his beard thin and sprinkled with gray. He had a flat nose and a swarthy complexion, revealing his origin. Now, even though Attila is almost always represented as a vicious warrior on horseback, slaughtering multitudes, the Roman writer Priscus describes him as a much more complex individual. He actually met and dined with Attila and presents him as such. He differed from other barbarian rulers in trusting to cunning more than to force. He ruled by using the heathen superstitions of his people to sanctify his majesty. His victories were prepared by the exaggerated stories of his cruelty, which perhaps he had himself originated. At last, even his Christian enemies called him the Scourge of God, and were so terrified by his cunning that only the Goths could save them. He could neither read nor write, but this did not detract from his intelligence. He was not a savage. He had a sense of honor and justice, and often proved himself more magnanimous than the Romans. He lived and dressed quite simply, ate and drank modestly, and left luxury to his inferiors, who loved to display their gold and silver utensils, harness and swords, and the delicate embroidery that attested the skillful fingers of their wives. Attila himself had many wives, but scorned that mixture of monogamy and debauchery which was popular in some circles of Ravenna and Rome. His palace was a huge log house, floored and walled with planed planks, but adorned with lengthy, elegantly carved or polished wood, and reinforced with carpets and skins to keep out the cold. Among the heathen superstitions, it's noted that the sword, war sword Attila carried, which he claimed was left for him by the Roman god of war, Mars. Now, Jordanes, according to the historian Jordanes, this was discovered by accident. Now, when a certain shepherd beheld one heifer of his flock limping and could find no cause for the wound, he anxiously followed the trail of blood and at length came to a sword that it had unwittingly trampled while nibbling the grass. He dug it up and took it straight to Attila. Attila rejoiced at this gift, and being ambitious, thought that he had been appointed ruler of the whole world, and that through the sword of Mars, supremacy in all wars was assured to him. Attila himself saw Rome as a feeble adversary, and one that could amuse him for years to come. The writer Ammianus Marcellinus, who was around from 330 to 391, wrote of the Huns in his History of Rome. He says that the nation of the Huns surpasses that of all other barbarians in wildness of life, and though the Huns do just bear the likeness of men of a very ugly pattern, they are so little advanced in civilization that they make no use of fire nor any kind of relish in the preparation of their food, but feed upon the roots which they find in the half-raw flesh of any sort of animal. I say half-raw because they give it a kind of cooking by placing it between their own thighs and the backs of their horses. When attacked, they will sometimes engage in regular battle. Then, going into the fight in order of columns, they fill the air with varied and discordant cries. More often, however, they fight in no regular order of battle, but by being extremely swift and sudden in their movements, they disperse and then rapidly come together again in loose array, spread havoc over vast plains, and flying over the rampart, they pillage the camp of their enemy almost before he has become aware of their approach. It must be owned that they are the most terrible of warriors because they fight at a distance, with missile weapons having sharpened bones admirably fashioned to the shaft. When in close combat with swords, they fight without regard to their own safety, and while their enemy is intent upon parrying the thrust of the swords, they throw a net over him, and so entangle his limbs so that he loses all power of walking and riding, and may be more easily slain. One other writer of this time says, relying on mobility and shock effect, Attila rarely committed his soldiers to close sustained combat. He preferred to approach his enemy using the terrain to hide his troops until he was within arrow range. While one rank fired at high angles to cause the defenders to raise their shield, another rank would fire directly into enemy lines. Once they had inflicted sufficient casualties, the Huns would then close in to finish off all survivors. Another historian, Jack Watkins, not from this time, but from a later period, of course, writes this of the Hun, of descriptions of the Huns' engagement at the Catalonian Plains or the Battle of Chalons. The Romans, and describes the battle as one of the bloodiest military conflicts in history. And this, of course, is the battle we talked about earlier, but it's important to note that he is looking at some of these accounts given by historians from the time, such as Jordanes and Priscus. The Romans occupying the high ground quickly succeeded in pushing the Huns back in confusion, and Attila had to harangue them to return to the fight. During the fierce hand-to-hand fighting, King Theodoric of the Goths was killed, but rather than discouraging the Visigoths, their king's death enraged them, and they fought with such spirit that the Huns were driven back to their camp as night fell. For several days, the Huns did not move from their encampment, but their archers succeeded in keeping the Romans at bay. The desertion of the frustrated Visigoths allowed Attila to withdraw his army from the field, and with his wagons, booty intact, the Romans did not pursue him, but his aura of invincibility had finally been shattered. Now, despite this, it still didn't stop, obviously did not stop Attila and his men from their campaigns. Now, following the death of Attila, we get accounts of Priscus that have been later translated by historians such as Durant and a few others, Christopher Kelly being one of them. Now, the transliteration of this, according to the Roman historian Priscus of Panium, he says they, that being the men of the army of Attila, had cut their long hair and slashed their cheeks, so that the greatest of all warriors should be mourned not with tears or the wailing of women, but with the blood of men. Then followed a day of grief, feasting, and funeral games, a combination of celebration and lamentation that had a long history in the ancient world. That night, far beyond the frontiers of the Roman Empire, Attila was buried. His body was encased in three coffins, the innermost covered in gold, a second in silver, and a third in iron. The gold and silver symbolized the plunder that Attila had seized, while the harsh gray iron recalled his victories in war. According to legend, a river was then diverted, Attila buried in the river's bed, and the waters were then released to flow over it, covering the spot. Those who had taken part in the funeral were murdered so that the place might never be revealed. According to Kelly, these two were honorable deaths in that they were part of the funeral honors for the great warrior who had brought his followers so far and accomplished so much for them. One writer, Lanning, says, remarks that Attila the Hun was the greatest battle captain of his age, his reputation striking terror in his enemies who feared and respected him. They called him the Scourge of God as a consequence of this. More than 1,500 years later, his name remains synonymous with aggressive cavalry and the warrior ethos. Interestingly enough, in March of 2014, there were claims that it was reported that Attila's tomb had in fact been discovered in Budapest, Hungary, which is now thought to have comprised part of Attila's capital of Buda. The find generated, of course, a great deal of interest, and one of the researchers was even quoted in reports as saying, in fact, this definitely seems to be the resting place of the almighty Attila, but further analysis needs to be done to confirm it. However, after further analysis by others not on the team that allegedly discovered the tomb, has revealed to be the claim, in fact, to be a hoax. Although scholars have often been skeptical of the story of Attila being buried beneath a river, there is King Gilgamesh was also said to have been buried beneath a river, specifically the Euphrates, and this, too, was long considered a myth. However, in the spring of 2003, a German team of archaeologists claimed to have discovered the tomb of Gilgamesh precisely where the ancient text says it was. So it's still unknown as to whether or not that is the case, but we may never truly know the resting place of Attila the Hun. But what we do know is that Attila the Hun, according to all of his contemporaries, was a magnanimous ruler to those who abided by his rule of law, and a cruel enemy to have. He left a path of destruction in his wake, the likes of which we shall never see again, and we should be thankful for that. But Attila the Hun carved a bloody path through what we would now consider to be not only modern-day Europe, but Russian steppes, parts of Russia, parts of the Middle East. It's clear that Attila the Hun may well be one of the most famous generals of all time, and will no doubt go down in history as not only a character that is quite notorious, but a man who achieved perhaps one of the greatest legacies one could ever attain. At one time, even being referred to as the wrath of God on earth. Truly inspiring, but also terrifying figure. And if you're interested in learning more about Attila the Hun, there are places, or just the Huns in general, there are places you can go. And I'm going to give you those places today. I've had a lot of fun doing this show today, and I hope you guys have enjoyed the show as much as I've enjoyed doing it. You might want to check out a few of these books if you're interested in learning more the Huns. Now, the first one that I would recommend is The Huns, Rome, and the Birth of Europe. This is a text that I think you guys would all find pretty valuable. It's written by Hyunjin Kim, and it's pretty well done. It's a great representation of ancient history, and anybody looking to learn a little bit more about the Roman Empire and their interaction with different tribes of people, as well as, of course, the issue with the Huns, probably something worth taking a look at. You might also take a look at Peter Heather's Huns and the End of the Roman Empire in Western Europe. Written in the Historical Review, still available, by the way. You can also take a look at Dennis Senor's The Cambridge History of Early Inner Asia, published with Cambridge University Press. Definitely a great look at that. You might also take a look at Walter Pohl Huns, Late Antiquity, A Guide to the Post-Classical World, which is edited by Glenn Warren Bowser-Sock. And the University of Harvard. And it's with the Harvard Ukrainian Studies. It is it's the Hunnic language of the Attila clan. It's a look at some of the names and some of the works of the Greeks and Romans at this time, trying to interpret and understand Hun culture. It's written by Omelion, so it's a good look at names of the members of the Hunnic dynasties, some of the attempts to sort of break down what little we have of their language, and take a look at some of, you know, perhaps pinning down where they came from by use of linguistic studies. So it's a fascinating look at their names and the attempts of scholars to sort of break down their origin based on the names that they use for themselves. That's all I've got for you guys today. Hope you've enjoyed the show. I hope you learned a lot about Attila and the Huns and their tremendous impact, because ultimately even though Attila and his Huns were particularly cruel, and they were a warlike people, they did help shape Europe, you know, with their persistence in attempting to sort of bring about the dissolution of both the eastern and western parts of the former Roman Empire, and the amount of people that were displaced by their actions in these parts of the world, it really did help to shape the culture and later the later nations that we would now call Europe. So it's important that we look at individuals like Attila and their impact on the world. You know, if we didn't see the Huns in their incursions into Eastern Europe and to Central Europe, perhaps Europe looks a lot different than it does today. So hope you guys enjoyed the show. I'll be back Friday when we talk about Joseph Stalin and his legacy. Hope you guys enjoyed today. Of course, you guys can catch me here Wednesdays, 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and of course, Friday at 5 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. And last but not least, do be sure to tune in Sunday for Straight Football Talk here with Totally Driven Entertainment with myself and Teddy Bear Tate. Do hope you guys enjoy the rest of your week. I will see you all on Friday when we talk about Joseph Stalin. Thanks for tuning in.